Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. New Zealand's prime minister receives worldwide praise for her response to the mosque shootings, while President Trump heard a sermon on hate speech when he attended a St. Patrick's Day church service in Washington, D.C. on Sunday. Perception is 9/10 of reality, and the world is perceiving these two leaders quite differently. What's going on here? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He was a Commonwealth scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge. He lectures at RMIT University, Melbourne, and joins us to discuss his latest counterpunch piece, Death in New Zealand, the Christchurch Shootings. Professor Benoy Campmark, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
It's a pleasure being with you.
So let's start with your piece in Counterpunch, Death in New Zealand, the Christchurch Shootings. What is the common theme or the prevailing thought that you want to convey with this piece?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind about what's been happening recently, certainly with the shootings that took place in Christchurch, is this attempt made essentially to assume some moral high ground, and so with values and so forth, and articulating them in certain ways. And the reality of this particular of these shootings is that there's several things at play here. There's not just the shooter's motivations and so forth and his background, but also the reality that it had to come from somewhere and so forth. And so what we're seeing here is that individuals such as the suspect, Mr. Tarrant and so forth, have a particular background that we have to take seriously. But it's also something where we've been noticing a certain, not smugness, but a moral distancing that's been taking place, that certain voices should not be heard, certain individuals should be silenced. In Australia, we see that with Senator Fraser Anning, for example. He's a classic case in point. So what we need to appraise here is a deeper understanding about the motivations for such individuals, be it of whatever extremist creed they might be.
You write in your piece, you talk about his so-called manifesto, that he had no criminal record, no watch list, no registry, nothing to suggest a tendency towards mass murder, disrespect, or mania. What he did have was a desire to avenge individuals he felt a kinship for.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and the thing about him, of course, is that precisely because he has no previous record, what he did, it seems, you know, is make a few trips overseas, and in the course of these trips, you know, from what we can gather and what was cobbled together in this so-called manifesto of his, he was influenced at stages about the possible impact of Islam on Europe. You know, he encountered, and some of the statements suggest, for example, in an aversion to historical Ottoman influence in the Balkans, these sorts of things. So he had absolutely no record. There was nothing suggesting he should be put on any list. You know, he was a disgruntled individual. Yes, we eventually, as it were, decided to let arms speak for him when it came to expressing so-called, as I said, kinship, when it came to matters of a particular race or the so-called European peoples, as he likes putting in his manifesto.
You write, the simple language of the note resembled that of various European populist platforms, albeit trimmed of deep historical flourishes, fear, the Islamic invader, take to the barricades to repel the forces of Allah. And as I opened my piece with, you have the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, winning praise for how she is managing this, while President Donald Trump basically gets rebuked when he goes to church on Sunday.
Yes. Well, when we think about, for example, some of the words of the Christchurch shooter suspect, we are also confronted by the reality that many governments in the world have decided to take a certain approach to various communities. And let's not forget that some of the language, for example, and I'm thinking specifically of, for example, Viktor Orban of Hungary, whose words would fit very well in the manifesto, Mr. Tarrant and so forth. You know, and of course, Mr. Trump has made it very clear at points, using certain language regarding certain communities in the United States, certain immigrant communities. So that's one view, and that's certainly one angle, which is, of course, polemical and whips up a degree of hysteria. The other approach is that of Jacinda Ardern, which is one of trying to offer some reconciliation and some conciliatory approach to the problems. She's done something, for example, of assisting relatives to fly in, you know, dealing with the tragedy and so forth. It's quite interesting to see how marked the approaches have been in terms of differences.
There's been discussion about the response of the New Zealand police force the day of the tragedies. Some are saying, how could this have happened, that the shooter, you know, was able to kill 49 people, was able to maim 50 in two different mosques. There are also reports that are saying that the police officers apprehended him in 36 minutes after receiving the first call, that they arrived on the shooting at the shooting of the first mosque. It seems about 9 minutes after the first call. And from the way they describe it, they almost bypassed each other, one going east, one going west, as he was going to the second shooting and they were responding to the first shooting. New Zealand had 49 murders last year, and then they had 49 in one day. Your thoughts on the discussion about response time and whether or not actually the prime minister should be held accountable because this happened on her watch?
Well, I think in a sense you answer your own question insofar as your observation about the number of deaths in New Zealand last year, faced with this appalling instance where the number of deaths is made up in the occasion of a few minutes. The reality was that when it comes down to approaching matters of such exceptional brutality, most police forces would have been quite taken aback. Anyone who's been to New Zealand will be aware it's quite a peaceful state, and instances of law and order are not as pronounced as problems. And the idea of a rapid response, of course, is always desirable. But these are the sorts of things that almost never happen, and certainly not in New Zealand. The mass shooting phenomenon has not crossed over to the Tasman and so on. But the reality of it was that, yes, the police might have responded sooner and so forth, but given the circumstances, the weaponry used, and remember the fact that these are open places of worship and so forth, which this shooter did strike, makes it very difficult to have necessarily engaged a proper response as quickly as it was needed. Because, of course, it just took a matter of minutes before the number of bodies accumulated. And that's something that was very problematic, of course.
You talk about the language in this so-called manifesto. You say other statements of motivation follow the enslavement of millions of Europeans from their lands by the Islamic slavers, the thousands of European lives lost to terror attacks throughout European lands, and a number of other things. What I really take from what I've read about this guy and what I read in his writings, an incredible disconnect and sense of alienation. And that seems to be growing in a world that is supposed to be better connected, a world that is supposed to be better informed. And what we seem to be having with the development of all these technologies are disconnection, not deeper connection. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It's one of the great paradoxes of modern communications and the modern technological and information society. What we're dealing with is an increased atomization of society. So the more connected individuals become through, for example, social media, the more the means they can communicate, the paradox is greater alienation along with that. Individuals such as the Christchurch shooter does. What we're speaking about here is our individuals who feel a sense of loss of power. You know, these are individuals, whether symbolic or actual. There's a sense that they have been left out, as it were, of the revolution, be it information, be it cultural, whatever it might be. The same statements are evident in, for example, the Australian politician I mentioned at the start of our discussion, Fraser Anning. he speaks in very similar tones. His language is that of a loss of control of immigration, the idea that there is a cultural Marxist conspiracy-style engineering happening in Australian society. So there is a lot of notions here of being dispossessed symbolically, not in actual fact, but dispossessed and deprived of influence in society that comes through. And that's very evident in the manifesto. It reeks of loss. It actually reeks of this sense of being deprived and generally the sense of privation, more broadly speaking.
We're talking with Professor Benoy Campmark. He has written a piece in Counterpunch, Death in New Zealand, the Christchurch shootings, and he lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne. I want to get your sense, being in Australia, in terms of Donald Trump and how these types of shootings are happening in the United States and his response to them. As an outsider looking in, how is this playing internationally?
Well, this interesting thing, broadly speaking, because what we have here, a couple of currents of discussion, certainly in the Australian context, what we see here is an attempt to, as I alluded to before, mention values in a particular way and talk about how individuals such as the Christchurch shooter and Senator Anning are not part of these values. But the reality is that these sorts of instances, shootings, vengeful as they are and so forth, come from a certain source. They are inspired by a certain approach and worldview. And the reality of it is that even, and this is something certainly in the Australian context that has to be faced up to, there is the so-called, and I don't like the term, the radicalization context, but in the background of it, there is something to be said about the normalized conduct in terms of the language that we see in the manifesto that was already taking place in Australia. Australia has been at the forefront of demonization, broadly speaking, when it comes to refugees and so on and so forth. So that's something to keep in mind here. So it doesn't just stem from nowhere, as a lot of these things tend to be. They have some sources of inspiration, broadly speaking. And even though Australia is not known for its mass shootings and so forth, there was, of course, the Port Arthur massacre, which created a drive for gun reform. There is a genuine sense that the mentality that came across in the shootings was deemed on some level acceptable. Maybe not the techniques used, but the mentality at least.
Well, in fact, you write, in Australia, Tony Burke of the Labour Party suggests punishing hate speech and denying visas to certain right-wing advocates of the white supremacist persuasion. Australia's immigration system is sufficiently intolerant and erratic enough to deny visas to those who might interfere with the false tranquility of its society, but a suspicious paternalism remains the enemy of free speech. Debate, in short, cannot be trusted. Some of that I see on the fringes here in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think one of the fascinating and in some cases very perturbing things, and we see that on several levels, is the attempt to control speech as well, or the attempts to limit discussion and so forth, however inimical the ideas might be. It shows, certainly in the United States, where you do have the very firm free speech protections, there is still an effort to try to rein in the use of certain language and so forth. So there is a sense that you can't have that open marketplace of ideas that supposedly drives this sort of discussion. In Australia, there is no equivalent, and certainly in terms of form, as the free speech amendment, but there is some modest protections implied in the Constitution on freedom to communicate on political subjects. But it does not come close at all to the nature of the free speech amendment. But the essence of that comment you mentioned by Tony Burke is important. It suggests a drive, and we will see more of that, of curbing speech that is deemed dangerous. And the problem is, who is to determine what's dangerous or not? And I find that very troublesome when it comes to these discussions.
I'm going to go back to what I opened with, a question that I asked about Donald Trump, because I'm really trying to get a sense of how this is playing outside of the United States. We had the Charlottesville shooting, wherein the president said there were good and bad people on both sides of the atrocity. Then we had the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. And so there's been this constant cry within the United States by people asking the president to speak out against white supremacy, to speak out against this type of hatred. And in the wake of the New Zealand shooting, once again, the outcry to speak out. And the president doesn't want to do that. So much so, he goes to church on Sunday, yesterday, and the minister wants to talk about the biblical justification for speaking out against hate speech, and he still refuses to do that, in contrast to Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. And so I was trying to see if you were noticing any international type of dialogue about what's going on by the leader of the free world, as it is alleged, in comparison to Jacinda Ardern.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. And in that particular sense, it is very striking that a lot of commentary and a lot of discussion is taking place on why Mr. Trump does not call some of these matters out. But of course, the reason why he does not do that is that he's trying to neutralize the influence of the violent aspect of the so-called white nationalist movement. When he was confronted about it, of course, by the press in terms of responding to the Christchurch shootings, he did say that it was a fringe movement, essentially, you know, nasty individuals and so on. But of course, the reality is that groups of individuals motivated by polarizing tendencies will at some point manifest, you know, or can manifest certain violent tendencies. It's not all of them by any means, but the reality is that there is an alienation taking place in society, what Mark Liller calls the shipwrecked minds. And so there is an element of these shipwrecked minds, as it were, who are trying to gather and find the wreckage of the certitude of their societies being ripped apart. And this comes whether it is Islamic fundamentalism on the one hand, or whether it is, in fact, white nationalism on the other. So these are the things that feed each other, in a sense. They're the nutrients upon which each other feeds. And this is something that Trump, of course, is not confronting. And it is something that others have noted in terms of how you respond to the other side of the violent spectrum.
You wrote in closing your piece in Counterpunch, there is also a stark, uncomfortable reality. No one is safe. The entire field of terrorist and anti-terrorist studies is replete with charlatan impulses and the promise of placebo-styled security. Talk about that. I think that is an incredibly, incredibly profound observation.
Well, the reality is that when we speak about a terrorist threat, and it was something that brings various so-called anti-terror or anti-terrorist strategies to mind, we see approaches made by the security state of the day to bring some kind of calculation or calculus in mind in terms of whether there'll be the next attack, whether there will be a serious threat, or is it moderate, or is it improbable, and so on and so on, high probability and so forth. So this kind of actuarial approach is a very interesting thing to see and does not in any sense address the reality. We simply cannot be assured about the total safety of places in open societies. If we don't respond in a severe way, we will curb back liberties. But if we also respond in certain ways that we have seen, we don't address problems either. So the reality is that, and hence the charlatanism element, terrorism studies is filled with lots of, shall we say, distractions from the actual substantive issue of history and society that affect people's individual actions. But unfortunately, when it comes down to the broader sense of it, we have to address this in a far deeper way than before. And unfortunately, we're not going to get that in the security response.
I don't know how much, if any, American television you pay attention to, but what you just closed with there, I find to be incredibly replete within the so-called analysis that we're receiving here. It's always put in a very simplistic, if not binary, context of them versus us.
Yes, of course. And that sells, that's easily packaged. And there is a sense of attempting to simplify very difficult problems, and this is something that governments, officials do, and that's where the placebo comes in. It's this idea that you'll be reassured that greater security at airports will supposedly prevent the next attack on an aircraft. You're assured that greater and heightened security measures, in a city, more checkpoints, greater, rings of steel around a city will necessarily do this. But we've seen time and time again that this does not necessarily prevent attacks. We saw that London's famous ring of steel in the course of trying to approach the IRA in terms of its bombings was efficient to some degree, but simply did not prevent, as it were, the scale of attacks that did take place. There's a kind of a normalized state of affairs here. So what happens is that you need reassurance, so governments give reassurance, but the reality of it is that we are simply not safe at any one point, at any one time. It could happen at any time.
I did not talk about the Dutch shooting because to me, there is still so much unknown about that. I will say that it is reported now that the Turkish-born man, Gökmen Tanis, who police said was the main suspect, he has been arrested. But there's still so much unknown about the details and the motivation behind that. I really did not want to get into a lot of discussion about that shooting. I didn't want to ask you to speculate.
No. I appreciate that, too, because you're quite right. It's still fresh, and the initial readings of it don't seem to be quite clear about the motivations and so forth. There seems to have been an instance where the suspect fired upon a lady at first instance who might have been his relative, I'm not entirely sure, and then apparently he fired on others who came to assistance. So it's something that we have to see in terms of motivation, how that unfolds and so forth.
I want you to comment on or elaborate just briefly on the closing paragraph. We have just about a minute. Death in New Zealand, the Christchurch shootings. You close by writing, "The actions of Friday demonstrate the ease with which an act of mass killing can take place. The damage then can arise from attacking freely open spaces where people commune. Extremism is said to lack a face or an ideology, but on Friday, it manifested in an all-too-human form."
Yes. Well, the reality is, and we keep seeing in the rhetoric in response to mass shootings, in this case the Christchurch shootings, that extremism has no face. But this is, of course, a classic way of trying to neutralize a point in a sense by suggesting that, it can't be understood in a way because it has no face. It's an abstraction. But far from it, extremism is a very, very easily reached stage in terms of development. It's a very easy turn to make. And I think by suggesting, even using the term extremism, we're talking about trying to distance the problem rather than confronting it. We're again trying to suggest that something rather serious is not to be confronted in the broader sense. And that's my problem with that. And so hence, of course, extremism did develop or had or manifested itself very seriously in the Friday shootings. And so this is something that has to be taken with a great degree of, with a great degree of caution when we see this, extremism does have faces and it can happen at any point across the board.
And in closing, again, going back to the paragraph before, you said, you talked about studies replete with charlatan impulses and the promise of placebo-style security. It made me wonder, have we met the enemy and is the enemy us?
Yes, and I think the reality is that in many instances we have within societies, as it were, the enemy there, and it is amongst us. It's not that we can easily and forensically and surgically remove the so-called enemy. It's very simply manifested and so forth, which is why I always caution against suggestions of how we are above people or we are above these people with values and so on. Well, if you start looking at the values carefully, you might be very surprised what you find in common across the board.
Benoy Campmark lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne, and he joins us to talk about his piece, "Death in New Zealand, the Christchurch Shootings." You can find it in Counterpunch. Sir, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Anytime.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Prosecutors, Transportation Department scrutinized development of Boeing 737 MAX. The Wall Street Journal is reporting federal prosecutors and Department of Transportation officials are scrutinizing the development of Boeing 737 MAX jetliners, according to people familiar with the matter. A grand jury in Washington, D.C. issued a broad subpoena dated March 11th to at least one person involved in the 737 MAX's development, seeking related documents, including correspondence, emails, and other messages. The subpoena, with a prosecutor from the Justice Department's Criminal Division listed as a contact, sought documents to be handed over later this month. To get some insight into how this issue is being handled, let's turn to my next guest. He's qualified on a number of Boeing 737 airliners, the 777, the 757, the 727, and Lockheed's L-1011s. He has around 100 hours on the Boeing MAX 900, around 10,000 hours in the 737, of which almost 7,000 are as a captain, and almost 25,000 total hours flying time. He will remain anonymous for this conversation. Let me just say, welcome.
Yes, thank you, sir.
First, your thoughts on learning that federal prosecutors and Department of Transportation officials are scrutinizing the development of Boeing's 737 MAX jetliners. Based on your experience in the cockpit, have you experienced problems that would have you turn to your first officer or have a captain turn to you and say, we're having some serious problems. Somebody needs to look into this stuff.
Dr. Leon, I have experienced some of those issues and some of those situations, but I'm going to give you some insight on something. And I'll start with the first topic that, you know, from watching the government now get involved and saying, hey, we have a problem. I think this is a systematic way that this country approaches things. They like to bring democracy to a country, but never uphold maintaining the process. This goes to the top of the chain for oversight, our FAA, Federal Aviation Administration. I learned how to fly in 1983, and one of the biggest fears we had as young pilots was, oh, my God, where's the FAA? I don't want to do anything and get in trouble with the FAA. I have to stay there to maintain the regulations and know what the stipulations are. As my career matured and I flew in the regional airline industry and then progressed to the major airline industry, working for several trunk carriers in the United States, flying international as well as domestic, we haven't seen the FAA at all. Individuals that retire from the airlines usually go to work for the FAA, and the FAA then oversights the manufacturers such as Boeing, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas in the United States. Airbus, when they bring a product to fly in our airspace, has to get kissed or processed to fly in American airspace. And these airplanes, Boeing 737 was a two-engine, small twin turbojet that carried 70 passengers that was manufactured in the late 60s, and then it was stretched. The engine capability became more technologically advanced, but the same wing stayed on the airplane, and the airplane carried more weight. Therefore, the performance criteria that the airplane maintained at altitude deteriorated somewhat. When we went from the 737 400 series and 300 series and 200 series to the what we call the new generation series, that was a big leap for the airplane. There was a more advanced engine, more computerization on the aircraft. And when I transitioned to that airplane at the airline I was currently flying for, we were given a videotape, went in the back, watched it for 30 minutes, and walked in the airplane and flew it cold turkey to Central and South America. The saving grace to that whole process was, in the United States, we hold a higher standard of doing things and researching things on our own. That same training process that was kissed by the FAA, what we call a principal operations inspector, whoever he was, allowed one airplane type rating or certification certificate to be now given for four types certifications under the same name, 737 to 200 to 300 to 400 to 500. Now you was able to fly the 700 to 800. Then the 900 series came out, the 900ER extra range came out, and then when the MAX came out, we were given the same criteria, computer-based training, in a sense self-taught, and there were lots of inside elements such as the MCAS system that we're concerned about right now with this airplane that was never illustrated to us in such detail that we would know what the capabilities of it were. But here we go back to basics. As a pilot, I know how to fly an airplane. If an airplane is giving me signs and signals and feels that are not comfortable and not correct, we turn things off. Both of these incidents in third world countries or second world countries, those pilots did not have the experience flying this airplane to recognize this airplane is not happy. And when an airplane is not happy and the autopilot's on, when the autopilot disengages, you know the airplane is not happy.
A couple of things. One, you said that as they stretched the plane, the wingspan stayed the same. They put more powerful engines on the same wing. Now, I've talked to a couple of different pilots. I had some folks on the show. They talked about stretching. They talked about the engines. I hadn't heard anybody talk about the wingspan staying the same. So is that at the core of this problem?
Essentially, no, it's not. If you have a certain amount of weight, a certain amount of cord area on the wing, that wing can support a certain amount of weight at different altitudes based upon the temperature. And this airplane has a real high-tech engine. To be honest with you, we never thought this issue was going to be the issue to worry about with this airplane. Pilots thought the engine was going to be the problem, the General Electric Gen X engine. That engine had some problems we had heard in certification because it has a big fan section on it that's a very lightweight piece of metal. It's composite. That fan section turns at a very low speed, such as 95% or 85% rotation, 80,000 RPM. That's the N1 section for our first stage compressors. The second stage compressors, the N2 section, turns at 110%, which means the second section is working very hard and the first section isn't working very hard. And it's a gearbox ratio, reduction ratio gears that slow it down. That particular mechanism would come apart on numerous occasions during the testing phases and certification phases for the engine. That's what we thought was going to be the problem with this airplane, not the computerization.
One of the things I was understanding was that MCAS system was reading a problem that didn't exist, forcing the nose of the plane to stall.
Yes, it actually senses the airplane. The sensors actually have two inputs to one of the main computers, and the aircraft anticipates that, oh my God, I'm going to stall. So it pitches the nose to a very steep angle, or a steep angle downward, or a steep angle upward. We learned in the 727, the 75, the 76, all aircraft, if the airplane does that, disconnect the stabilizer trim, turn the electric motors off. And that's an automatic reaction thing. Oppose the yoke, and which means the guy on the right side pushes his yoke forward, you push opposite, and disconnect the autopilot, disconnect the auto throttles. In the process of doing that, there's two stabilizer trim switches, turn them off.
How long does it take for you to do that? When you feel your plane isn't happy and you realize that this is the maneuver that you have to, or the actions that you have to take, how long does it take you to do that?
The same amount of tempo I just gave it to you. It's a memory item. It's a known memory item. It means instantaneously that's what you do. Just like if you lose pressurization, oxygen mask on, crew communication is established, and verify and fly the airplane to make sure you can breathe before you can operate. It's called a memory item. And that memory item for that particular item for the airplane at my airline was not illustrated in that fashion for this particular issue because that's a flight control known. That's a known item. Pilots in the United States that fly know that's what you do when you have a runaway stab trim. That I noticed this morning when I was on my way to Boston. I hand flew the airplane to about 25,000 feet. In some of these countries that have these aircraft, they put the autopilot on at a minimum of 1,000 feet. Sometimes they put it on the lower. We have what's called limitations in the airplane. It means an absolute limitation, the absolute limit that you can do something. Some of these guys put the autopilot on immediately when they come off the ground and they manage the aircraft with the autopilot because they can't fly. In the United States of America, with 200 hours total time, you can't earn a commercial license. You need 1,500 hours total time to earn a commercial license, a four-year college degree or high school equivalency, sound mind and body, medical certificates. That's a minimum. The airlines won't hire you. I wasn't hired at my first airline until I had 6,000 hours total time. So the majority of the guys I'm flying with right now are coming on board with 6,000 to 8,000 to 10,000 hours total time, and they hand fly. In these countries, these people don't have flight time. So when that happens, the first thing is the physical psyche. Oh, my God, the airplane's falling apart. Nobody's flying the plane. Then somebody takes over the aircraft and is flying it. And at that time, the airplane's pitched up 40 degrees nose up. What am I doing? And you're behind the aircraft. When you get behind the aircraft inertia and weight and you stall it, transport category aircraft, when they're stalled, they don't recover like small Cessnas in a matter of a couple hundred feet. Sometimes it takes a couple thousand feet. Both these incidents were low to the ground.
Let me try to make an analogy that's very simplistic. When you said getting behind the aircraft, the first thing that came to my mind was icy road, my car starts to go into a spin. I would say I'm now behind the automobile. I know it's very simplistic, but is that a, when you talk about getting behind the aircraft, is that a apt analogy?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay.
It means you have become a passenger in the front row.
Got it.
In the front of the aircraft.
Got it.
And that's not where a pilot needs to be. A pilot needs to be ahead of the aircraft.
Got it.
Today, coming to Boston, I had at least a minimum of two places to bring my airplane in the event I had an emergency descent. I had an idea of where I was going to bring the aircraft based upon the runway length, based upon how much time the aircraft was going to take to descend to marginalize, even in a glide with no power. An average of 10 to 15 miles, that aircraft could have glided from 37,000 feet to successfully land, even if I had to land it on the interstate highway. And I'm always thinking ahead of the aircraft. You don't wait until the problem happens to think, what am I going to do now? How can I land this aircraft at night if it's in smoke? What am I going to do now? Captains and pilots don't think that way here. In foreign countries, a lot, and I hate to say it that way, that's not taught. And the oversight to make sure it's done correctly isn't there. And we're having a problem with that oversight issue right now in this country.
I think Elaine Chao said, we're waiting on data. When you heard the president say, we're waiting on data, Boeing is a sound company. Boeing came out and said that the MAX was airworthy. To me, you're waiting on data. Well, I'm a data-driven guy. To me, 346 people have died in less than 6 months on two airplane crashes. I don't need any more data to shut this thing down until we know exactly what's going on. What were your thoughts on how this thing was handled when the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 dropped out of the sky?
That can go many ways, and I don't have the time to really hit it with you on the show right now, but I'll put it to you this way. In all of our training, we spend 3 or 4 days doing emergency procedures and technologically things that work with the aircraft. We usually spend a day or a half a day looking at what other people have done that's been stupid, and we get it from data. The airplane tells on us. When we land at the end of the night, the mechanics plug in a computer socket, and the aircraft will tell if the airplane was oversped. There's certain speeds you put flaps down at. There's certain speeds you put the wheels down at. There's certain temperatures that the engines can do. Certain altitudes you fly. And if we exceed those things, those limitations, and don't tell daddy in the office that, hey, I made a mistake. When they plug in at night, they know what that crew did. Some airports have unstable approach criteria. San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, California, the controllers will drop you in real fast, tell you to slow. You're doing 250, they'll tell you slow to 190, descend and maintain 2,000, right turn, slow to 145, you got traffic 12 o'clock in front of you. We can make the airplane do it, but sometimes it's not very comfortable and it's not the thing to do. And when they see these things or trends that are happening over and over, that gets flagged and called. They'll have someone call air traffic control and say, hey, you're making these airplanes do some things that are pushing the limits. The data is very important. So they're waiting for it because that's the box. That's what gives us a base guideline. Boeing made a great product. The 900 MAX flies beautiful. But what they did is they changed the flight controls on the airplane to match with these new 787 has and the 777 has, which is a fly-by-wire flight control system. And the airplane has a lot of data happening with sensors. Now, American Airlines has two sensors, two angle of attack sensors on their airplanes. Everyone else only has one. Questions that pilots are asking is, what did America know that no one else knew? Now, here's a little something I'm going to tell you that's really going to freak you out. I'm aware that that issue, what happened in Ethiopia and what happened in Thailand, happened to two airplanes in my airline, and it was recovered successfully, and not a problem was done. And it was recorded and noted to Boeing, and Boeing recognized maybe the sensor is too sensitive in recognizing a situation that we're in that's really not happening. So that's why you're hearing the information that Boeing's going to reload the information, and they're going to reinstitute this to your computerization. That's where that's coming from. This is happening as we speak, but it's happening to pilots that are comfortable and competent and capable. And this is where they redraw the guidelines. Well, who's in charge of letting the foreign carriers that bought these aircraft know the same thing, the principal operating rules of governing in other countries? I don't know. That's why Boeing is like, shame on you. Because, once again, the oversight that tells them to do this isn't doing it. And we as pilots, we're mad. We're not happy because when we were given this aircraft, we were never told anything about the system. Nothing about it. Because we knew if something happened, there's a multitude of things can happen on any airplane on any given day that I know basically how I'm going to fly the aircraft. And there may not be a procedure for it, but I know how to get that airplane safely on the ground. This was one of those things, turn the stabilizer trim off. Common sense tells us to do that. But when you're dealing with someone that has a lesser amount of experience, they don't know that. And every day in your hometown of Washington, New York, Boston, and all across America, there's a carrier coming from somewhere else around the world, has a captain with 10,000 hours in it, and the first officer with 150 to 200 hours in it. And they usually offer very cheap tickets, and everybody I'm talking to, listening on the station, if they were given a ticket, they'd take it happily and ride, and not knowing if something happens to that captain, you're in bad shape.
Let me go back, because I didn't quite understand the answer you gave me. When the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed, killing 157 people, after the Lion Airline crashed, countries around the world grounded the plane. The United States was the last country to do so after Canada. We were being told during that period, Boeing says it's fine to fly, it's airworthy. And again, others were saying, we're waiting on data. Well, I don't know. How much more data do you need?
I see what you're saying now. Oversight. This is where your governing agency was quiet and not there. We were told before the president made the comment to shut the airlines down, Boeing had already issued the airworthiness directive to ground the aircraft. For some reason, he jumped in and he took credit for that. And we're not going to go there about that situation. But
right.
Boeing had already made the comment to ground the aircraft. Why did it take so long? I have no clue.
Okay.
I have no clue. Pilots are not happy. I can tell you that. In the crew room, guys are not very satisfied about it.
They did say that the president on Monday was on the phone with the CEO of Boeing, and Tuesday he was saying everything's still good. So
he was also with the CEO of Boeing in Korea selling a whole lot of Boeing products that if that deal didn't go through, he would have really looked bad. You know what the rest of the story is on that.
Now, Ethiopian Air sent the black boxes to France.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were expecting that the black boxes would be sent to the United States.
As well as myself.
Okay. I think I know why, but let me ask you. Why do you think—
They don't trust us.
Oh, well, then that's the answer. That was my answer.
They don't trust us. We've lost a lot of credibility in the world recently. And I'm going to give you another heads up on something. I was really surprised at the level of experience that was flying that particular airplane with Ethiopian Air. On behalf of the Ethiopian Airlines pilots— very well-qualified pilots, some of the most professional airmen on the North Atlantic. I have flown with them before. I know some of them personally. Very, 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 very well, in more detail than God knows what. They weren't trained. They weren't trained. I could fly the space shuttle next week if you train me for it. But if I'm not trained, I don't know what I'm doing. And you have to be exposed to the scenarios and to the situations. Training has gotten watered down in the last 7 to 10 years because of economics. There was a time when I was at TWA years ago, we sat in classrooms with neckties on, and we sat in class like ninth grade from 8 o'clock in the morning till 6 in the afternoon, and the instructor physically spoke to us. Now, at my current company and other companies around, we have an iPad. We do what's called computer-based training, and when the module is complete, you show up for the next level of training, which is the simulator, and you know your call-outs and your procedures, and you go through training. It's shortened possibly by maybe 2.5 to 3 weeks. For you not to have a hotel room, have to have extra pay to have to stay there, and a lot of other things.
And aren't there fewer of you? Aren't there fewer pilots now?
Yes, there's two pilots, but the workload is summarized basically computerization and the planning.
I said, aren't there fewer pilots now? So aren't there more pilots flying more hours instead of when you were talking about 7 to 10 years ago? Weren't there more pilots?
Well, the companies are smaller basically because the aircraft have went down to two-man cockpit. My company currently has over 12,000, 13,000 pilots. So the companies have gotten smaller, and the rest regulations changed because of an accident. That was recent as well. So the rest periods have gotten shorter. And for the staffing, everything is adequately staffed, but we're losing a lot of pilots for retirement right now. So the backfill that's coming in the United States is a pilot that hasn't physically flown an airplane that has what we call round dials or diesel dials, where you have gauges that turn, you have what's now the computer screen, or you have television screen type flying where you have a map showing.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology has really been good for safety for that because it really gives you a better situational awareness for what you're doing, but training has gotten watered down. And once again, oversight approved it. Okay, yes. It's okay to go on and do something that took 20 hours to do. It's okay to go on and give you credit for it after you do 5 hours of it, is what I'm saying. So what you're seeing is a shortened, they've cheapened up the process.
Gotcha.
To put it honest to you, they've cheapened it up. And most pilots currently, and some of the guys from the old school, I learned from the old school, and most guys from my generation and from the old school, even though they learned it in the training room, they went home and they studied it in the book. I have every aircraft I've ever flown, I've gotten a maintenance manual for it. And I learned how the system works, where that system would leak from, what would cause that system to break. And every week I take a system and I read. And when guys start asking questions about things, I can tell them that system works this way and this is going to happen if you put it down here and that's going to be the effect of it there. And that's how they develop a lot of rules and institutions that we deal with in the industry is they see, you know, you put the flaps down at 300 knots and all of a sudden we started getting a lot of hydraulic failure. So let's back it down and put the flaps down at 250 knots. So rather than that, to save the power control units, let's put them down at 210 knots. Boeing makes a phenomenal product. And I give them credit for that, but they didn't give the whole manual to the purchaser to learn how to fly this product well enough. They failed on that. Okay. They absolutely failed on it.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
I really appreciate your time. We're gonna stick to the anonymous agreement, but it's obvious to me you know what you're talking about. Stay safe. Thank you so much, and I look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Anytime. Appreciate it. Y'all have a pleasant day.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. U.S. campaign to ban Huawei overseas stumbles as allies resist. The Trump administration's aggressive campaign to prevent countries from using Huawei and other Chinese telecommunications equipment in their next-generation wireless networks has faltered, with even some of America's closest allies rejecting the United States' argument that the companies pose a security threat. Well, what's really going on here and why? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's director and senior news analyst at the William Lloyd Garrison Center for Libertarian Advocacy Journalism, Thomas L. Knapp. Mr. Knapp, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Good afternoon, Dr. Leon.
So give us your insight into why has the United States been so aggressive at trying to stop its European allies and other countries from deploying the Huawei 5G network?
I would put it in one word, protectionism. If you go back a year, this is before Huawei, Broadcom, a company in Singapore, attempted to buy Qualcomm in the U.S., and they're chip makers. Their chips are used in 5G tech. And the Trump administration vetoed that merger on the supposed concern that Broadcom would deploy the technology for production in China. That was a $100 billion-plus merger that the Trump administration quashed in the name of national security. It's really all about trying to keep the U.S. in the tech lead for the next generation of telecommunications. National security is just the excuse.
Let's talk a little bit about 5G, because a lot of people, I think, are operating from the misnomer that 5G is just slightly faster 4G. And I think what people really need to understand is, as we talk about the IoT, the Internet of Things, as we talk about the true next, this is truly the next generation of communications. Analogy I use, it's going from the two tin cans connected by a string to the Internet.
I don't think that's really overstating it at all. It's a big leap in the ability to have fast data transmission, to actually be able to do from your phone what you can do on your desktop without slow connections, without unreliable connections. It's going to be a big change.
So Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, he's pledging to withhold intelligence from nations that continue to use Chinese telecommunications equipment. And one of the things that I find laughable about that is you don't have to do a whole lot of reading to understand Huawei's involvement in and oversight of some of the undersea cables, where a lot of the data that Mike Pompeo is so trying to withhold or wants to protect, it goes through Huawei cable.
Very true. I find the whole national security claim to just be stupid. If we go back a few years to Edward Snowden's revelations, I don't think anybody's worried about the Chinese spying on their communications. They know that the U.S. is.
Well, that isn't that what the NSA is for?
Yeah, that's what they do. And you know, I just can't imagine that the U.S. would be concerned that there might be technology that they don't have backdoor access to.
Now, I'm hearing commercials already. Verizon is using the term 5G in some of their commercials now. Sprint is using the term 5G in some of their commercials now. This is not a rollout of a 5G network. Explain to my audience why the United States is so far behind the eight ball on this one.
Since Barack Obama's Asia pivot, we've been at loggerheads with the Chinese. Trump has amplified that. The U.S. is more or less splitting off into its own tech universe in the hopes that the world will follow it like it always has. And now it looks like the U.S. may be the one that gets left behind.
What people need to understand here is this is not just a matter of routers and modem. This is a network issue. This is a matter of cell towers. This is a matter of cabling. This is you have to build out 5G. You can't just put a 5G router on one end and a 5G router on the other end and use the same infrastructure to transmit the data. And so as I understand it, China has been building this entire network out, and they're basically ready to flip the switch. And the United States is saying, no, if you flip that switch on 5G, the U.S. is out of the race.
Well, I don't know how far China is toward actually deploying, but I do know that last year with the Broadcom-Qualcomm merger, that was the concern, was you have to have all these new towers that deploy the mini arrays of specific antennas for 5G. And Qualcomm and Broadcom are the two rival chip makers, and the Trump administration did not want them merging.
So talk to me about the angle or the approach from the William Lloyd Garrison Center for Libertarian Advocacy Journalism. What is it that you all find about this issue that is of interest to you?
Well, we're pro-free trade. And the fact is that if you look at the tech world, different functions happen in different countries because of division of labor and because of comparative advantage. The Trump administration is sort of like reaching onto the poker table and trying to rake all the chips to the U.S. side. And by impeding that trade, they're impeding the rollout of 5G. You know, they think they're impeding it in the world, but actually they're impeding it in the U.S., and the rest of the world is going to leave us behind.
But I thought Donald Trump was pro-free trade.
No.
Did he tell me that?
You've heard about his tariffs.
Yeah.
You've heard about his trade wars. He talks about, quote, fair trade, unquote, a whole lot of bad economics, a whole lot of protectionism. This is certainly not about free trade, and it's not about national security. It's about trying to artificially constrain 5G to where you have to come to the U.S. to buy your parts, to buy your tech, to buy your expertise. And China is finally in a position to compete with the U.S., for that market on a level playing field. So Donald Trump doesn't want a level playing field.
And it's interesting because China reached out to the United States a couple of years ago and was talking to us about joint ventures and joint development. And we thumbed our noses at them and told them, that's okay. We're going to go our own route.
Well, I can't crawl inside the mind of Donald Trump, but he is a protectionist and he seems to believe that if workers and employers and producers and technologists in one country get a win, that somehow everybody else loses. We all gain when these technologies roll out. And if some of them happen to come from China or the EU or wherever, why would we want to cut off our own nose to spite our face just because we don't get the whole market?
I'm going to ask you this question. This is my my theory, and you can tell me if you have any insight into this. A couple months ago, China, they sent a rover to the dark side of the moon, and a lot of folks got very excited about that. So now there's this, I guess, this Chinese dune buggy riding around on the dark side of the moon. And my thing was, this is really a communication story. This isn't about China and a dune buggy on the dark side of the moon. This is about the communications satellite that China had to position in order to be able to communicate with that vehicle. And that this is a signal that they are so far ahead of us in this field of technology that is frightening. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if they're ahead of us. I know that to the extent that we constrain trade with them, they will be the ones who get ahead because of it, not us. The U.S. loses when it refuses to trade freely with other countries in technology or anything else.
But Donald Trump told me that he's the guy with the art of the deal, that he's the guy that truly understands what's in the best interest of the United States, that he can negotiate this thing. He told me it was going to be simple.
Well, I wouldn't bet the ranch on anything Donald Trump tells you. That's all I can really say.
Gotcha. Wow. So how do you see this playing out going forward? Because we know this is not a security issue. Our allies know this is not a security issue. They want to move forward with the technology as quickly as they can. So from a free trade perspective, how do you see this thing playing itself out?
Well, the rest of the world is about to get full-blown 5G. Whether the U.S. gets it or not is up to our government, and right now they don't seem inclined to let us have it. It works the same way as tariffs. When you impose a tariff on a good, you're not punishing that other country. You're punishing your own consumers by forcing them to pay more or forbidding them from buying something. So to the extent that this fight plays out, the only real outcome can be that American consumers lose the ability to get a new technology because their government, you know, is worried about China.
And do you see this as an element or a factor in the ongoing trade talks that are taking place between President Trump and President Xi Jinping?
Well, I mean, they hold the details of those trade talks fairly close to the vest, but I can't imagine that it's not coming up.
Okay. This is frightening to me because we could really be left holding the bag on this one.
Well, we could be left behind. In the next stage of the tech renaissance, America could be in the dust at the back of the pack instead of leading it.
Gotcha. Thomas L. Knapp, Director and Senior News Analyst at the William Lloyd Garrison Center for Libertarian Advocacy Journalism, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leap.
Thank you, sir. All right, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.